Proposals are due the first Sunday of every month, and selected pitches are heard the third Thursday of every month. Once again, pitch your awesome ideas at awesomekingston.org.
Vous écoutez CFRC, ici Charlotte Cardin.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls, and you're listening to Rainbow Country.
Today on Rainbow Country, a spotlight on queer female filmmakers. That and more next. So stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hello, my name is Conchita.
And I'm Barbie Q.
And my name is Hardcora. And we are the B-Girls.
You're listening to
Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello and welcome to Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. As always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. Well, thanks to you, tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately, listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into an award-winning, nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a number one LGBT podcast. So, today, a spotlight on queer female filmmakers. Rising Through the Fray, a Canadian documentary that follows Indigenous Rising, a roller derby team preparing to claim their space on the roller derby track as the first borderless team in the sport. By the way, Rising Through the Fray is getting a national theatrical release from January 29th to April 23rd in select cities. Joining me to talk about all things Fray is the film's award-winning writer and director, Courtney Montour. Plus, later in the hour, Egghead and Twinkie, a coming-of-age LGBTQ plus comedy about an out Asian American teen and her nerdy best friend who set off on a 2,000-mile road trip to meet her online crush. Joining me to talk about Egghead and Twinkie is the film's writer and director, award-winning filmmaker, Sarah Combe-Holland. In Hour 2, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. Our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, author Lori Green reads from her book, Drag Queens and Beauty Queens, Contesting Femininity in the World's Playground.
New York Avenue, where the party began. Mortimer breathes deeply and gestures broadly with his arms at the now vacant lots and rundown buildings on the west side of New York Avenue. The Saratoga was here, he points behind us. And the Shea Perry Disco. He turns and walks toward the world-famous boardwalk and makes a right on Westminster, commonly known as Snake Alley, a winding back street that connects the New York, Kentucky, and Mount Vernon Avenues in the old neighborhood. The parking lot to the right used to be the Entertainments Club, the oldest bar on the East Coast. Louise Mack, who loved gay people, owned the building, and the bottom floor was her little speakeasy nightclub, which always catered to gay men. It was one of those places where you had to knock on the door and have a code word to get in. Mortimer continues to walk, looking around, gesturing toward two large parking lots on the opposite side of the street, where the Grand Central Hotel and Studios 5 and 6 once stood before they burned down. He laughs as he kicks an abandoned beer bottle toward the curb. Gay rooming houses and hotels once choked the streets here, and it was all gay everywhere. He turns and frowns as he rounds another corner of the ghosts of properties where it was easy to pick up young men for sex and rent boys, especially in the 1980s. We turn onto Kentucky Avenue, where Snake Alley ends, now a devastated parking lot, as he describes the hotels and gay businesses that used to line the west side of the street. On the corner of Pacific and Kentucky Avenues, on the right-hand side was the coffee mill. On the left-hand side, the Atlantic City Electric Company. Across the street was Kelsey's Restaurant, and what used to be a pool hall and pizza parlor, rooming houses, a little gay grocery store. He pauses and points across the street to a small house, which still has a plant in the window. This is where drag queen Sandy Beach lived. Mortimer points to a little window where he remembers losing his virginity. He shakes his head, surveying the empty space. Turning right on Pacific Avenue, we walk past an empty lot, which was once Lyle's, a gay breakfast place where everybody ended up after staying out all night partying. Two prostitutes walk by, followed by their pimp arguing about cigarettes. Turning right, back down New York Avenue, he summons the ghosts of gay clubs once again, the Saratoga, the Shea, the Rendezvous, where he used to perform in drag, and where he saw his first gay sex inside the club, right on the dance floor. On the right side stood the Chester Inn, its restaurant called the Front Porch. And there was an underground club here called Pucolani with a pool. Across the street was an Italian restaurant, Mama Mott's, where he had his first gay date. It's all gone now. Camp and the queering of Miss America. The corner of New York Avenue and the boardwalk in Atlantic City Beach side is the girls' side of the street. The spot where lesbians congregate to watch the parade and cheer as the cars go by carrying the Miss America pageant contestants. On the opposite side of the boardwalk, gay men stand in front of Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum waiting for the parade to begin. This year, there is an added intrigue, since this is the first time an openly lesbian contestant, Miss Missouri Erin O'Flaherty, is competing for the crown as America's ideal woman. Many spectators carry rainbow flags. Some are dressed in drag, men in full makeup, women donning t-shirts with men's chests and muscular arms painted on them. Others wear rainbow kitsch, plastic sunglasses, boas, crystal-studded crowns. Both men and women flirt with local police as they beg to stand pressed up against the parade route and promise they will behave in return. Drag queen Morgan Wells stands in a gown and a headpiece on the men's side. Beside her stands a man shirtless with pierced nipples attached to chains. Gay men congregate, sorted by age and acquaintance, under the marquee of the museum. To their right quietly sits a family with beach chairs and three small tow-headed children on their laps. Shoobies, or out-of-towners as we call them, they gawk at the spectacle before them. The convertible carrying the Miss America contestants in the Show Us Your Shoes parade pass in alphabetical order. They wear costumes whimsically representing their states, with shoes held up in the air with one leg as they lean back in their seats and wave to the crowds. Show us your shoes, is screamed from New York Avenue crowds as each contestant passes. And as they do, most of them met with cheers of encouragement, waving rainbow flags, while others receive sometimes not so flattering critiques of their tepid presentations. You on New York Avenue now, honey. You ain't in Kansas anymore, someone yells in the crowd. A baton twirling team from Kentucky approaches. The young girls dressed in rainbow colored leotards draw near, and the excitement among onlookers builds. They all respond by waving their rainbow flags and chanting, twirl, girl, twirl, Twirl, girl, twirl, as they jump up and down and continue to wave their flags. The twirlers, a little disconcerted, perform their number. Flags begin waving and people push in toward the yellow cones along the parade route. Miss Missouri Erna Flaherty is dressed in a blue and white baseball uniform and holding up a pair of bejeweled high-top sneakers. As the convertible nears, the cheers increase. She smiles, but she is demure as she waves. Jean runs toward the car, waving her rainbow flag. And though Erin smiles and waves back, she appears a bit awkward with this group of locals looking for some acknowledgement of their shared identity. The crowd chants, "Show us your shoes. Show us your shoes, not your midriffs." Mimi on First stands at the top of the risers as she enters wearing a 12-foot-long purple bejeweled velvet octopus stole with arms wrapped around her torso and dragging down the steps behind her. Hair high in a platinum blonde bouffant, her lips bright red, Mimi cocks her head, turns, and drops the stole coyly, revealing a sparkling black velvet swimsuit and a gold and purple shell accessories. She struts, turns her back to the audience and winks. A finger goes to her lips as if to say, "Oh my, I'm so exposed." She seems oblivious to her fatness. In fact, she shows a confidence in her superior form, her extra large body jiggling, hands on her hips accentuating her simple frame. Mimi walks down the runway, stopping at the end. She licks her lips slowly, turns, and walks back to center stage, moving her hips slowly to the music. Mimi on First, contestant number one, is announced, along with her measurements, 72, 48, 72. The crowd cheers and applauds, and she bends over slowly, paws and bottom to the audience to retrieve her stole. As Mimi is escorted away by Speedo-clad male dancers, the next contestant begins to descend. Farrah Mascara steps gracefully, one stilettoed foot after the other in a sequined red row. As she reaches the stage, her robe falls away, revealing a red cutout sequined swimsuit, fishnet stockings, and a giant lobster clawed hands as gloves. She moves her thumbs, pinching the air, flashing an open mouth toothy smile. She shakes her head side to side, her huge hair just seconds behind her. Farrah struts from one side to the other as she makes her way down the runway, ending in a figure eight, pinching claws held high. She shimmies and jiggles her large body, putting one claw to her mouth in feigned embarrassment. Miss Farrah Mascara, contestant number two. Her favorite food is chicken nuggets. Her favorite color is the rainbow. Farrah squeals and grabs the arm of one of her escorts as the next contestant appears at the top of the risers in a gold lamé robe cinched around her waist. Tina Burner descends in sparkly white platform shoes and reveals her swimsuit, white and skirted, with a gold belt and an anchor and gold tasseled epaulets on her shoulders. Tina's ginger hair is coiffed 1950s style, and she holds a captain's nautical cap, posing, one knee bent, arms by her side, wrist flexed, head cocked to one side. She walks slowly to the top of the runway and puts one white gloved hand to her mouth as she knocks her knees together and giggles. Tina Burner, contestant number three. Her favorite perfume is fishy.
'69 was a big year. It was the year that saw both the Stonewall riots in New York and more or less decriminalization of gay sex in Canada. The following year, the Americans celebrated the anniversary of Stonewall with Christopher Street Liberation Day. That was the summer of 1970. They didn't actually call it Pride at the time. August 1st, 71 was Toronto's first official gay picnic at Hanlon's Point. It was organized by the Community Homophile Association of Toronto and Toronto Gay Action. 300 people showed up. Now, that wasn't officially a pride, but Gerald Moldenhauer, one of the veterans of those days, maintains that a march down Yonge Street a few weeks later should be called the first Toronto Pride. That was a warm-up for the more famous We Demand demonstration in Ottawa, held August 28th that year, a protest against the inadequacies of Trudeau's decriminalization. By the way, if you want to see some pictures of those early days, check out Gerald's website. It's GeraldMoldenhauer.com, and it's spelled GeraldMoldenhauer. The first official Toronto Pride was actually the next year, 1972, again in August. Then there was a second Gay Pride Week, August 17th to 26th, 1973. That one was national, not just Toronto. There were events and marches in Vancouver, Saskatoon, Ottawa, Montreal, and Halifax. The focus was political, on ending discrimination against queers, something that was still quite legal across the country at the time. Then, the following year, 1974, there was Pride number 3 in Toronto, August 17th. I came out of that one, so I remember it very, very well. We marched over to Queen's Park to again demand human rights protection. And then they stopped. There was nothing in 75. People were focused on a national lesbian and gay conference in Ottawa. And again in 76, all of us in Toronto were busily preparing to host the 4th National Lesbian and Gay Conference, which happened in September. Gay Days was a big festival in 78, but nothing called itself Pride again until 1981 after the Bath Raids. That's where the misconception that Pride began after the Bath Raids comes from. 81, I suppose, is significant because that's when the shift happened from August to the last weekend in June to harmonize with Prides across the U.S. But that's not the first Pride. So when you hear someone say that the first Toronto Pride was in 1981, you should politely point out that that's not quite true. Toronto and other cities in Canada had our own August Prides for almost a decade before that. And there are still those of us around who remember. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Up next, Rising Through the Fray.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
We are Indigenous Rising Roller Derby. Today we are here representing 17 nations.
Good blocking up front by the Indigenous Rising blockers. Those teams working really hard.
Having Team Indigenous and knowing that there are other amazing, strong Indigenous skaters fighting for these skills and these rosters just like me is empowering.
I think that we've all gone through a time in our lives where we have been ridiculed and been faced with racism. I was never proud of who I was, being called multiple horrible names that children should not hear was hard growing up. But I'm not going to be that stereotype.
When I started playing roller derby for Indigenous Rising, it just meant the world to me to stand within a circle of people who, without me saying a word, could tell me more about my experience than anyone else.
I fight for you, and you fight for me.
If Team Indigenous can bring awareness to more people about our Indigenous cultures, then we've won.
Strong, resilient, indigenous!
Courtney Montour. Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am good. Am I saying your name correctly, Courtney Montour?
Yep, that's perfect.
Well, yay, well done to me. Well done to me. Okay, let's start here. You are an award-winning filmmaker, writer, director. Your most recent film is your feature-length film, a documentary Rising Through the Fray. Congrats on your feature-length debut. Congrats on that. Let's start from the ground and build up. Talk to me essentially about the story that you're telling in this documentary. What's this all about?
Yeah, well, Rising Through the Fray is about Indigenous Rising, and they are the first borderless team in roller derby. So what that means is in 2018, they came out at the Roller Derby World Cup in Manchester in the UK and gathered a team and said, you know what, we don't want to represent, you know, a country, a state, a province. We don't want to represent these colonial borders that were put upon us. And they applied as a team of Indigenous women from around the world representing their nations collectively. And to me, it was jaw-dropping. It was a groundbreaking moment, not only in roller derby, but just to see, it hadn't been done before, to see that many different nations of women, Indigenous women coming together to be represented on a team. And for me, it was like, there needs to be a film about this. It's so important to see this kind of representation.
So Rising Through the Fray tells the story of the Indigenous roller derby team, Indigenous Rising. You were just talking about, you know, essentially how this came about, but the origins for that, the spark for that, what gave you the idea to want to tell this story then?
Yeah. Well, so I'm a Gunnegahaga filmmaker from Gunawage, and I've been working in documentary for like about 18 years now. And to me, issues of identity are just so important to bring up and share, because I feel like there's lots of outside kind of oppressing factors at times, systemic, historically, that really impact our individual and collective identity. And it was really interesting for me to be able to bring those ideas into a film that is also about roller derby, because a lot of people don't necessarily know what roller derby is. And to me, it's just such a fun, amazing sport to watch. I'm from the Montreal area, so we have like one of the top leagues in the world, and we have access to roller derby here to watch it all the time. And it's just such a fast-paced sport, two teams on roller skates, on quads, you know, going against each other to try to see like which player on their team will be scoring the points. It's highly competitive. It's a full contact sport. And it's all women and non-binary individuals who are on the main roller derby teams. So that in itself is just a really cool, fun sport to watch. And then you bring in this layer of Indigenous Rising, and my mind was kind of blown. Like I said, a historic, groundbreaking moment. And when you bring those two things together, we now have a starting point to really get into some very emotional, personal storytelling.
Well said, well said. So Rising Through the Fray will have a Canadian National theatrical release. Yeah. Congrats on that. From essentially January 29th to April 23rd in select cities. How exciting and how excited are you to have your debut feature-length film in theaters across Canada? What does this mean for you?
Yeah, it really is fantastic. We started off with a strong festival run, especially when we premiered here in Montreal at RIDM, and then afterwards at Image and Nation. Just the love and the packed houses and the conversations that came out afterward, there was just so much engagement because people saw themselves reflected in these stories of trying to figure out your identity and where you belong and being seen and represented. So to be able to bring this now to theatrical screenings across the country is just, it's so important. There's just, again, the experience to see a film, you know, with an audience, it's just, it just adds so much to it. You know, you get to hear those emotional moments, the laughter, some tears. And I think there's you just hold on to that more, and it, the stories of Indigenous Rising will sit with you even more.
Hmm. So cities like, there's Montreal, there's Edmonton, there's Winnipeg, there's Sherbrooke, there's Ottawa. Watch out, cities, because here comes the fray.
I love that. Yes, so, yes. Yeah, so, it's coming, and maybe even more.
Yes, from your lips to God's ears. So here's I just mentioned the fray, Rising Through the Fray. That's the title.
Yes.
Is there a story behind this particular title for this film, for this documentary?
Yeah. Well, I mean, fray, basically, like, the meaning is, like, you know, chaos, disorder, and it's a term that's actually used by some of the announcers in roller derby when they're on the track and some of the teams are being blocked or stopped from the other team. And it's like, oh, they're caught in the fray. They're trying to get through the fray. So that's where the title came from, because that's literally what Indigenous Rising is doing. They are, you know, rising through the fray and showing people who they are and being proud.
Okay, 2021, American Indian Film Festival, Best Short Documentary, and the winner is you for Married Two Acts Early, I Am Indian Again. 2025, Canadian Screen Awards, Best Writing Documentary, and the winner is you and journalist Tanya Talaga for the CBC documentary series, The Knowing. So here's the question. When did you first get introduced to film and your love of film? When did this all originate for you?
You know, it really started, you'd say, almost by chance. I graduated in journalism, but it didn't connect with me. I felt like it wasn't a field I wanted to work in. It didn't feel like I had time to connect with the individuals that I'd be interviewing. And then a filmmaker suggested I should reach out to Mushkeg Media, which was a Cree production company in Montreal at the time, led by Paul Rickard and George Hargrave. And to go try my hand out there, that they were really supportive of mentoring individuals coming up in the field. And that's where my love for working in the documentary field came from. And I think that's so important. And it's what I try to bring through in my work as well, to mentor and support other filmmakers, you know, regardless of the skill level that they're at. I think we need to do that, support each other, learn from each other to be able to move forward. And that was the formative years for me, where I got to try my hands out on everything. And they were really supportive of, you know, taking me out on shoots. And I fell in love with directing and with writing, and realizing that we had a chance to tell our story our ways, to really spend time with the individuals in the films. And that is the thing that still sticks with me, that it's their story that's going to live on forever, that the individuals in the films need to be involved in that process of telling their story, and that relationship with them continues beyond the film. And now there's a connection with that person, and I think that's really important. And that's what shines through in Rising Through the Fray. It was a really collaborative process over many years with Indigenous Rising.
I just mentioned a couple of your awards just a few moments ago, and I think it's fair to say that you don't necessarily get into the creative arts to win awards. In your case, 2025 Canadian Screen Awards. Congrats on that and your other award. But being recognized for your work, being seen for your work, generally speaking, what does that mean to you? What does that mean for you?
You know, what it means, these awards, it's recognition that, you know, our peers and the general public is watching these stories and connecting with our Indigenous realities and histories. And that's, to me, that's what's important. I also love showing my work in educational institutions. And I think the kind of work that I create, and even with Rising Through the Fray, it's to introduce people to our lived experiences and in a really intimate, welcoming way that can also be very emotional, but it's a starting off point that now someone, they want to learn more, they can go out there and find the resources to start that learning or share the information about these stories.
What was the most challenging part about bringing Rising Through the Fray to the big screen? What was the most challenging part for you?
You know, there were little things here and there, like COVID. COVID shut down roller derby for 3 years. I mean, the whole world shut, but it was something that was very challenging for the sport because it is a completely DIY sport. Everyone pays their own way to play. I mean, it's a huge investment. All of these individuals are just, it's a passion project of them. And they volunteer to, you know, to ref, to coach, everything. So the sport, you know, really had to shut down because nobody could pay to, like, you know, quarantine teams in hotel rooms to play during COVID. And so we had to stop filming for that period of time and stay in contact with the team, but wonder, is the team going to come back? And it was really special when they did. Like, we filmed with them in 2019 for one shoot. And then the next time that we shot again was when the team came back together, and that was in 2023 at the All-Stars tournament in Louisiana. So I think there was also something really beautiful to be with them again as they were reforming, rebranding, bringing new players on, and like meeting for the first time in a parking lot to start warming up and training for the first time. We were there with them, and that shows in the film, and we follow that journey of the team.
Quote, roller derby was a mainstay in my baby queer years. Attending live games in Montreal, a roller derby hub, is a unique electric vibe all its own that is rooted in queer community gathering. Unquote. That's a quote of yours. Here's my last question for you, and it's simply this. What do you hope audiences come away with after they've seen Rising Through the Fray? What do you hope audiences come away with?
I am hoping that people see their own stories reflected in Indigenous Rising, no matter what background they come from, the sense of navigating to find out who you are, and needing to see representation and that feeling of belonging. I hope it also introduces the general public to a really fantastic female empowering sport that many people might not know about. And for young Indigenous people to
to see this team and be proud and be like, hey, I can go and do this. Whether it's in roller derby or elsewhere, you know, I can do a sport like this.
Well said, well said. Courtney Montour, well said, well done, well filmed, well made. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Mark.
We are Indigenous Rising Roller Derby. Today we are here representing 17 nations.
Good blocking up front by the Indigenous Rising blockers. Owen Payne's working really hard.
Having Team Indigenous and knowing that there are other amazing, strong Indigenous skaters fighting for these skills and these rosters just like me is empowering.
I think that we've all gone through a time in our lives where we have been ridiculed and been faced with racism. I was never proud of who I was, being called multiple horrible names that children should not hear was hard growing up. But I'm not going to be that stereotype.
When I started playing roller derby for Indigenous Rising, it just meant the world to me to stand within a circle of people who, without me saying a word, could tell me more about my experience than anyone else.
And I tell you, I look like a fox, I look like a bull. I fight for you, and you fight for me.
If Team Indigenous can bring awareness to more people about our Indigenous cultures, then we've won.
Strong, resilient, Indigenous!
That was my spotlight on award-winning filmmaker Courtney Montour and the new Canadian documentary, Rising Through the Fray, which hits theaters in Montreal, Edmonton, Winnipeg, Sherbrooke, and Ottawa, starting January 29th. For more information, simply visit risingthemovie.com. When I return, Egghead and Twinkie.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B of TGCD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
If you, or maybe someone you know, would like to be a guest on Rainbow Country to get the word out about an upcoming project, maybe you have an interesting story or journey to share, well, simply head over to marktara.ca where everything is connected and send me an email. It's just that simple. And you too can have your voice and your story be heard coast to coast.
Hi there, I'm Bennett Singer, a documentary filmmaker and the co-director of the new film, Cured. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
So, you're a lesbian?
Yes, I'm gay.
You can't possibly know that. You're too young.
I'm 17.
When I was 17, I wanted to be a marine biologist. And now look at me. I'm in real estate.
I'm running away. Right now. Are you in?
What? Where are you going?
It's
Texas. I don't know, I thought it'd be fun. You know, one last hurrah before college.
Twinkie, you sound insane. Is this about last night? Because I really didn't mean to make things awkward.
What about last night?
Never mind.
Here we go. Dallas, Texas, baby.
Let's do this.
Someone popular. Who are you talking to?
Just a friend from summer camp.
Liar! That makes three lies so far.
You were saying.
Was I supposed to know that you were gay the whole time? Because now I just feel like an idiot.
Hey! Yeah, I don't know. Guess I thought you already knew.
I see the way that boy looks at you. Two are gonna be just fine.
I've known that I was gay since the fifth grade. And it's like everybody thinks that they know me better than I do.
My best friend, and you're not acting like yourself.
I'm just trying to exist and have a life, and sometimes it feels like you can't be a part of that anymore.
Twinkie!
Rise and shine. Today we're gonna turn that frown upside down.
Well, lucky for you, we don't have to stop for snacks. What? Why? Snack it!
What? That's awesome!
Gummy bears, gummy worms, Cheetos, popcorn, baby wipes.
Baby wipes?
Well, yeah, for the Cheeto dust.
Duh!
Hey, duh!
Sarah Combe Holland, hello. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I am well. Okay, so we just went back and forth there for a hot minute. How do you say your name correctly, especially your middle name?
It's Combe, so Sarah Combe Holland.
There you go.
Yeah, I have to make it hard for people, you know. Yeah.
I have to say thank you so much for being here, to have your voice, your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. So thank you for this, especially to talk about your film, your feature-length film, your award-winning feature-length film, Egghead and Twinkie. I like to start from the base and build up. So talk to me about essentially the story that you're telling in your award-winning feature-length film, Egghead and Twinkie, and what's the story that you're telling?
Yeah, happy to. Egghead and Twinkie follows these two teenage best friends named Egghead and Twinkie as they travel across the country on this spontaneous road trip to meet Twinkie's online crush in person for the very first time. So it's kind of like a road trip movie, buddy comedy, teen movie all rolled into one.
I often like to talk about things that jump out to me in a film, whether it's a short film or a feature length, as in this case. The very opening really draws you in, a combination of live action, animation, voiceover. The opening of this film, was this always the intent? How did the opening come to be?
That's a really great question. It's actually a discovery that was made in post. So that whole intro, the animated intro where we see, you know, cartoon Egghead and Twinkie kind of introduces herself, that was all created in the post-production process. So in the script, it was supposed to open with the scene that now comes after the intro, with Egghead and Twinkie in the diner. They're mad at each other. We don't know why. So kind of like this cold open thing where we're just thrown right in the middle of it. But it was during test screenings that we realized that opening was really not working because people were like, who are these people? Why are they fighting? And they weren't like intrigued. They just didn't understand what was going on, or like they weren't invested because they didn't know who these people were. So that's where we did some thinking, and one of our editors on the project, Christy, she was like, what if we opened it like into the Spider-Verse and we do this animated opening where we kind of catch everybody up to how we got here kind of thing. So yeah, it was a fun discovery that happened during the edit process.
Fascinating. It's amazing how things work out, eh?
Yeah, it is.
The film Egghead and Twinkie, this is based on your award-winning short film, 2019 award-winning short film, Egghead and Twinkie. So here's the question. What originally inspired this story that started off as a short and now a feature length? What's the genesis for Egghead and Twinkie?
Yeah, it's been such a long road because Egghead and Twinkie originally started as a proof of concept short film. It was around 9 minutes long. So I guess if I'm including that, kind of the genesis of the idea of those characters, Egghead and Twinkie, that started when I was 19 and I'm 27 now, so do the math. But I think originally the idea, it came to me because I had just come out to my own parents and the coming out process was very fresh in mind. And I think I really wanted to make a comedy about coming out because I hadn't really seen that done. I feel like coming out historically has always been portrayed as something really scary and overwhelmingly negative, which I mean, it can be, but I think there is a certain power in being able to laugh at scary things. So I was like, oh, I want to make a comedy. And that's kind of where Egghead and Twinkie started.
So is it fair to say that this film is autobiographical then?
No, not really. it's definitely a fictional story, and Twinkie is honestly very different from me. She is her own person. I think it's more so just like certain feelings that I felt growing up, you know, as a teen, you know, being queer and mixed Asian, there are certain things I can relate to Twinkie about, but the story itself is definitely fictional.
Music. You use music really well. It helps to tell the narrative at times. Talk to me about the process of choosing the music that you do, because it's great. It's a great aspect of the film.
Thank you. Yeah, I was super picky about the music, so I'm so glad to hear that. The music,
and it's also very retro in a sense, like almost like very 80s.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I listen to a lot of 80s music, so that honestly makes sense. On my Spotify Wrapped, Spotify told me 80s is my biggest genre, so I'll take that as a compliment. But yeah, the music, it was a big process because, you know, we're a super scrappy micro-budget film, so like trying to get all the licensing for all those tracks was a huge, huge process, and especially trying to get them to like work with us at our budget level. But a lot of those artists were like super indie, kind of hipster niche artists that I had found over the years. And it was a lot of reaching out to people and chasing them down with the help of our music supervisors, trying to get that licensing in place. But yeah, I made those playlists very early on when I was writing the film. So it was really awesome to get to use a lot of those same tracks that I'd been listening to from the beginning. Mm.
So what was the process like for you? As you just said, this is a micro budget film, indie, scrappy. What was the process like for you to make this feature length film? Did you run up against a lot of, you know, obstacles, like people saying, no, you can't tell this queer story, you can't tell this LGBT story? What was the process like?
Well, the good news about your point about, oh, you can't tell this story, is that because we were making it on such a small scale and because we were basically doing it all ourselves, there was no like studio or big exec to tell us no. So, I mean, I got to tell the story I wanted to tell. I think more so it was just the obstacles were related to, you know, do we have enough money for this? How do we get this person to come down, you know, to our budget level? Or how do we get these 22 locations when we only have X money? So it was a lot of like being creative, I guess, to get what we needed. Yeah, it was challenging. I mean, it's a road trip movie, so there's like 22 different locations, and just trying to get all that in order and, you know, plan out a shooting schedule that made sense for people was pretty complicated.
Best comedy feature, Cinquest Film Festival. Best narrative feature, Florida Film Festival, and Chicago LGBTQ Plus International Film Festival. Just three awards that your film Egghead and Twinkie have earned. What do you think it is with your film that resonates, that is resonating with audiences? What is it about your film that you think people are liking?
Oh, that's a great question. I think there are various aspects of the film that resonate with different people. I think maybe one of the most global themes is friendship, best friendship. You know, I think people resonate with that when they see Egghead and Twinkie together and just their dynamic and how much they love each other and how that kind of grows and changes over the course of the film as Twinkie comes out. I think also a lot of queer people of all ages have come up to me and say that they felt represented or that they wish they had this film when they were growing up. And that's been really rewarding to hear.
Yellow on the outside, white on the inside, Twinkie. I haven't heard the term Twinkie before, but I've heard munja cake. I've heard coconut, all that sort of stuff, especially within the LGBT community. Talk to me about this aspect of the film and how this came to be, how this is included in the film, and the origins of the name Twinkie.
Yeah, it's a complicated and nuanced issue, because mm-hmm. Twinkie is the main character and she calls herself Twinkie. She's like, that's what I want to be referred to as, when Twinkie is commonly an insult, you know, used against Asian American people that are too Americanized, or like, oh, whitewashed, or however you want to phrase it. Mm-hmm. So it was something I was a little nervous to include in the film, honestly, especially mm-hmm. since the movie is like so silly, goofy, and, you know, lighthearted. And then to kind of touch on racial themes was something I really wanted to do right by. But I felt like it was important. It was something that was a part of the script. It was a part of the short from the very beginning, because I did want to open up this conversation about what it means to be Asian American, what it means to be mixed race. I think a lot of people in the Asian American community struggle with not feeling Asian enough for whatever reason, whether that's because they're mixed or adopted, or maybe they've been in America for many generations and they don't feel as connected to their culture. So I wanted to at least start a conversation about it, because I do think it's something that would be impacting Twinkie, especially with her growing up in kind of like white suburbia in Florida. Mm-hmm.
I too am mixed race and, you know, multiracial. And so I could relate to not necessarily the term Twinkie, but the idea of, you know, not fitting in, not being this enough or that enough. And when that was happening in the film, I was like, well done to Twinkie to take that term back and owning it, so that people can weaponize it against her. It's like, you're a Twinkie. It's like, yeah, I am. So what? Let's move on, shall we?
Yeah, and I think that's such an interesting thing that happens, right? Like reclamation of words. Mm-hmm. Like that's something we see in the LGBT community as well, with so many people identifying as queer and using that word now. And for the longest time, like that was a no-no word to use. So it is just kind of an interesting thing, different, I think, minority groups reclaiming certain words that maybe have a bad history.
The title, Egghead and Twinkie, is there an origin story to how this particular title came to be?
Well, it started with naming the characters first, and I guess the name of Twinkie popped into my head because I was thinking about all those things we just discussed, you know, racial identity and such. And then Egghead just came along shortly after. I don't know, it's weird. I like didn't really think about it. It all just kind of fell into place. And I was like, oh, that sounds nice. I like those names. It fits the characters. And then the title, you know, just makes sense to put them both together.
Here's my last question for you. You are an award-winning filmmaker. Your feature-length film is out now to the world to see. What do you hope audiences come away with after they've seen Egghead and Twinkie?
Oh, well, I've been told, and this is one of my favorite compliments about the film, but I've been told this from a few different people now, different reviewers, that watching this movie feels like a warm hug. So I hope that that's what it feels like, you know, for people that go and stream it, because I think as we've kind of talked about in this conversation, there's like a lot of darkness in the world, and I think it's easy to feel kind of hopeless sometimes. So I hope that this movie is just like a nice escape for people, that they can watch it and feel that warm hug feeling, and you know that there are people out there like Egghead that will accept them for who they are unconditionally.
Well, I have to say, Sarah Combe Holland, well said, well done, well filmed, well made. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show. Very enjoyable. Very enjoyable of this film, Egghead and Twinkie. Well done.
Thank you, Mark. I'm glad you think so.
So, you're a lesbian?
Yes, I'm gay.
You can't possibly know that. You're too young.
I'm 17.
When I was 17, I wanted to be a marine biologist. And now look at me. I'm in real estate.
I'm running away. Right now. Are you in?
What? What? Where are you going?
Texas. I don't know. I thought it'd be fun. You know, one last hurrah before college.
Twinkie, you sound insane. Is this about last night? Because I really didn't mean to make things awkward.
What about last night?
Never mind.
Here we go. Dallas, Texas, baby.
Let's do this.
one pop will learn.
Who are you talking to?
Just a friend from summer camp.
Liar! That makes three lies so far.
You were saying.
Was I supposed to know that you were gay the whole time? Because now I just feel like an idiot.
Hey! Yeah, I don't know. Guess I thought you already knew. I see the way that boy looks at you. Two are gonna be just fine.
I've known that I was gay since the fifth grade. And it's like, everybody thinks that they know me better than I do.
You're my best friend and you're not acting like yourself.
I'm just trying to exist and have a life, and sometimes it feels like you can't be a part of that anymore.
Twinkie! Rise and shine! Today we're gonna turn that frown upside down. Well, lucky for you, we don't have to stop for snacks. What? Why? Stack it!
What? That's awesome!
Gummy bears, gummy worms, Cheetos, popcorn, baby wipes.
Baby wipes?
Well, yeah, for the Cheeto dust.
Duh!
Hey, duh!
That was my spotlight on award-winning filmmaker Sarah Combe-Holland and her latest release. For more information, simply visit eggheadandtwinkie.com.
Hi, I'm songwriter and producer Jim Valance, and you are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, She Tell You, The Parachute Club.
It's a matter of time, we've come a long way from her heart. We've been looking behind when all the signs pointed to the start. The music talks the silence of a sleeping zone.
We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Gordep of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara. This is hour two of Rainbow Country, where I feature music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we